But what I want to do today is continue our series in Joshua. I might turn to Joshua chapter 6. And we started a little bit late, but I'm hoping to have enough time at the end to play part of that video that I played a couple weeks ago that came from this Patterns of Evidence. And this takes you through the entire Exodus all the way through Jericho and Joshua and then on to Hazor and some others. So if you have enough time, I'm going to play this. But even if not, I'm going to give a copy of this DVD to Eunice. She told me last week she wanted to have it. So she'll have it and she can watch it and then you get it from her and we'll just pass it around in case you want to buy your own. So again, I just thought if you didn't have a chance to see all the video, it's really encouraging to realize that we do have great archaeological evidence for our faith. Isn't that something? So we're going to, first of all, of course, spend some time here talking about the Battle of Jericho. And, of course, it's probably one of the best-known stories of the Old Testament. So I want to try to bring some different perspective to it today. But it's certainly a time in which it encourages us, even when we seem like we're facing one of those mountains that Jared was talking about, that certainly we can still see victory. And we see, of course, the conquering of this walled city and then the sparing of Rahab and her family. So that's kind of our story. If you want to understand its geographical and political significance, it's interesting. Jericho may be one of the lowest cities on earth geographically because it's right there, very close, of course, to the Dead Sea, which is the lowest body of water on this planet. And so, again, you can see it's way below sea level. It was also one of the oldest cities and really is, when you say city, it's more like a fortress is really what it was. And it was one of the earliest cities to fortify. And when we come to it right now, there aren't as many women and children. It's primarily a fort. And so that will be important in just a minute to answer some of the questions some of you have had. Also, it was spring fed. So even while they closed those gates, they still have access to water. And so it seemed from everybody's vantage point to be impenetrable because even if you could lay siege, oftentimes eventually they would run out of food, they would run out of water. And this is not something that Joshua could depend on at all. And so we'll see that, of course, they've closed the gates itself in anticipation of the siege. Again, geographically, and as Parker mentioned, you can see those maps better if you look on that. You can see where they cross down there where, of course, the waters were held back all the way up to Adam. They go to Gilgal, and then, of course, now they're heading to Jericho. And so this is the opportunity to learn a little bit more. I'm not going to read all of this just so we have a little bit of time at the end for the video and encourage you to read it on your own. But let's look at, real quickly at Joshua 6, and I'll pick out a few passages here that are very important. Chapter 6, verse 2, for example. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See that I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor." And then it talks about, of course, marching around the city for 6 days where you have 7 priests, verse 4, 7 trumpets. And then on the 7th day, you march around 7 times and you blow the trumpets. And so then Joshua calls them to bring up, as we can see in verse 6 here, to take the ark of the covenant and let 7 priests bear the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord. Then we go on and learn a little bit more about the 7 priests and the 7 trumpets and all that they are going to be doing. But then, interesting enough, in verse 10, then Joshua commanded the people, "You shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any voice or word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you, then you shall shout." So you can imagine just the image that you have here of the people looking out over the walls of Jericho. And each day they see this group cycle around once and nothing is said. There's no horns that are blown. There's no one saying anything. And they see this for 6 days. And after a while, this had to be an event. You know, everybody's at the walls kind of looking over, wondering what happens. And then by the 7th day, they go around 7 times, and then they finally shout. And you can begin to sense that they would actually conclude, as I said in my handout here, this is a rather strange battle plan. Would you not think so? I mean, think about this. You know, here we see in verse 2 that Joshua and the commander of the Lord's army, which some people might believe that is a Christophany, discussed the battle. And then it says, interesting enough, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand." Now, we have different tenses. You know, we have past tense and present tense in English. But there is a tense, interesting enough, in Hebrew called, as you can see it there, the prophetic present tense, the prophetic perfect present tense, where he says, "I have delivered." In other words, it's already been accomplished. And so even though he's still looking at this incredible fortress, which from a human point of view seems impossible to take. The Lord of the Lord's army, the commander of the Lord's army says, it's already done. It is a done deal. And so you can kind of imagine Joshua at this particular point. You know, here he's an experienced warrior. We can see different battles that he has fought all the way back in Exodus. We have read about fighting against the Amalekites and some other smaller battles that have taken place. And so here now he's being told that you're not going to use a battering ram. You're not going to use any scaling tools, not going to use any ladders to try to go over these walls. But instead, you're going to have seven priests blow seven trumpets continuously before the Ark of the Lord, and no one is going to speak during that time. And that's exactly the battle plan that you have. The instruments of the warfare are not mentioned, only the instruments of worship are mentioned. And even when it later says they took the city, there's no mention about whether they drew their swords, how they took the city, or anything like that, because the focus in this chapter is not on the battle. The focus of this chapter is on what the Lord did. And so here we only see the instruments of worship, and that talks a little bit more about the Ark of the Covenant, and we know a little bit more about what's in the Ark of the Covenant. I put this, and you might want to put this in your notes or look at it a little bit later. In Hebrews 9, it tells us what is in there, the Ten Commandments, the jar of the manna, Aaron's rod. And again, if you're not familiar, this is what it looked like to give you a sense of what they were carrying around. And this, no doubt, because it was inlaid with gold, as they're marching around, probably shone quite a bit. I mean, it was shiny. It was getting everybody's attention. And so the focus, again, is not on those warriors. It's a debate as to whether or not all 40,000 of them were marching around with the Ark of the Covenant or not. We can leave that, but whether they were or not, the one thing that would catch your eye if you were in Jericho, and certainly what caught the eye of all the Israelites, is this shining Ark of the Covenant being carried along in the sunlight. And so, again, the attempt constantly was to say, don't look at your weapons, don't look at your 40,000 men that are armed, but instead look to the Lord. And I think that's the real lesson that we pick out of this particular passage. Now, interestingly enough, the Ark of the Covenant also gives us a little bit of a New Testament glimmer, because what you have is that the law in the Old Testament really did not save you from sins. We went through the book of Hebrews a couple of months ago. Remember how we said the law did not save you? The law just shows you your sin. But even there in the Ark of the Covenant, let me back up, is that mercy seat. And so in that mercy seat is the idea that here is where salvation can come. At that time, what happened is the blood was sprinkled upon the mercy seat, and that sprinkling the blood on the mercy seat was the sacrifice at that particular time of the year to forgive all those sins. But now we have, of course, Jesus Christ, the great sacrifice, the great Lamb, the Lamb of God, who is a once-for-all sacrifice. And so, again, we can see how even as this Ark of the Covenant is making its way around Jericho once a day for 6 days and then seven times on the seventh day, we can even kind of see a little bit of an implication as well for what is going to come in the future. Then we also have the fact that the sacrifice was there to atone for the sins, for their shortcomings of not living up to the law. And we also see that some of the other items of note involved the fact that these used these trumpets. That's going to come back in just a few minutes when we talk about some of the application points you can see on the handout. These were not ordinary trumpets. These were what were called jubilee trumpets, and they were used during a solemn feast. As a matter of fact, one of the things I talked about with Dr. Tony Evans is that he's been doing some of these solemn assemblies all over the country, in places like Ferguson, Missouri. You can imagine why he did it there. And there's going to be a solemn assembly that Tony Evans is doing in September. And so as we get a little bit closer, we're going to talk about that. Again, some of the same people I was with in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago, and Graham Watts and all sorts of people are all going to be at this event. And so I'm going to see if we can get us into that solemn assembly that will be taking place here in Dallas. But this is all based upon in the Old Testament sometimes when they would seek the Lord and pray for God's redemption and forgiveness, there would be a solemn assembly. And here, these are not just any kind of trumpets. These are the trumpets that were used during those trumpet, jubilee, solemn assemblies where they would pray and seek God's face. So there's kind of a natural connection between what we see here in these trumpets and what we'll be praying for this Thursday in our National Day of Prayer. Finally, I think it also shows something else, that in this particular case, the spiritual battle is won by surrender. In this sense, surrender not to those warriors in Jericho, but surrender to God's plan. And he and Israel did not have to really exert much effort to win. The fact that they're just sort of all in a footnote, the walls fell and they took the city. Really? You know, as an action movie kind of guy, I'd like to know a little more about that, but no, that's all it is. It's just done. And it is also theoretically possible. I can't prove this from the scriptures, but think about this for a minute. Everybody had to be looking out at the walls when they're going around seven times. If the walls fall, what happens to you? You know, I think it's quite possible that the walls killed a fair number of people, that either falling from that height or having the walls fall down on them, that basically when Joshua and the 40,000 men go into the city, it's just pretty much a cleanup operation because so many of them were killed by the action of God. Wouldn't that make sense? And if that is the case, you can see why, again, there's just very little talked about in terms of the actual battle itself. Finally, of course, we see that God shows victory over this. And so, again, just recognize what we are about ready to now see come down. You've got this retaining wall, which is about 10 to 12 feet high. So it's as high as this. And that's just the part that then takes you to the first wall. And we know how those are because there's a little bit. I'll show you some of the archaeology that we have. Those were 26 feet high. But then there is an open space where there were some homes built in there, and I will show you some of that in just a minute, in some of the archaeology. But nevertheless, then you have that other wall that is another 26 feet high and 6 feet thick. So you can begin to see that this seems like an impossibility in terms of being able to take this, and yet we see with God, it's not very difficult at all. Turn with me again to Joshua chapter 6. We'll start in verse 22. And again, I'll just scan some of the passage here so that we have enough time. But then it reminds us once again that as these walls come down, they are the case. And I misnumbered those. That should be a little further up there because we have on the seventh day they rose, verse 16 and 15. Then, of course, the shout to the Lord has given you the city. So then back in our verse 20, so the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout and the wall went down flat so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. That's all we have, really. Then they devoted all to the city and to destruction, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, donkeys, edge of the sword. But to the two men who had spied out the land, Joshua said, go into the prostitute's house and bring out from there the woman and all who belonged to her as you swore to her. And of course, they bring them out. And so we see that in verse 25, Rahab and the prostitute and the father's household and all who belonged to her father, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out to Jericho. We'll talk more about her marrying Boaz, and then, of course, Boaz being the grandfather of David and all the rest. But then an interesting statement at the end, which I want to also pick up on, verse 26. Joshua laid an oath on them at the time, saying, cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds this city Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation, and at the cost of his younger son shall he set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was all in the land. And we'll look at that curse in just a minute. But now we've come to the fall of Jericho. And this gives you a little bit of a diagram of what would happen as the walls begin to fall a little bit. They're walking around. And so you have the ramparts, you have that wall, you have a few houses in there, then you have the second wall. And those are all now coming down and crashing down. And in many cases may have led to a fair amount of death even in that particular case. But the battle victory, pretty straightforward. We see that Joshua gives the command, shout for the Lord has given you the city. And of course, even though this is kind of an exciting part of the story, I want to also focus on something else. And that's what we just read in verses 17 to 19, because it says, keep nothing for yourselves. This victory and its spoils belong to God. And to understand this, it really is to say that unlike what happens when oftentimes you take a city and those spoils are brought back into the camp, you are to leave those there and you are to burn those. And so that's kind of an unusual set of circumstances, which is why we can then, from an archaeological point of view, point back to when that took place. Donald Campbell, who used to be the president of Dallas Theological Seminary, in his commentary put it this way, said, the context of Jericho were to be given to the Lord as the first fruits of the land. Just as you have the first fruits of the crop that are given to the Lord as the tithe that we talk about here today, also we see that the conquest was to be given to the Lord, and so they were not to take any of the spoils of the war, Lord, of the war there. And the verse in verse 17 actually uses the Hebrew word haram, and I'm going to come back to that in just a minute, or else sometimes it uses the noun harem, and this was the idea to destroy completely. So when someone destroys something that had originally been devoted, that means they don't have access. And I think God did that to say, look, we want to destroy Jericho. We don't want you to take over Jericho. We don't want you to reoccupy it. This has been a place of evil. This has been a place of child sacrifice. This is a place of paganism. We want it destroyed, and it, to this day, is destroyed. Nobody's ever built again on that land. We'll look at that picture in just a minute. And so as a result, they would not be tempted to go back and occupy that city. Well, this creates a very interesting archaeological set of circumstances, because if you go to other tells, archaeological digs where cities have been destroyed, you can see how they ransacked the city. There's not a lot left in there. When you go to Jericho, you find just the opposite. The first thing we find is that this particular place was destroyed by fire. And we can read in verse 24 here that it was to be burned. More importantly, though, these are some pictures of the burned grain that were in the jars. Well, that tells us two things. First of all, the grain had just been collected, and so as a result, that means that the destruction of this city took place in what? The spring, during the spring harvest. We know when this took place because, remember, they celebrated what? Passover. We just celebrated Passover right here. So it's starting to match up. Grain, spring, all the rest. But then, more importantly, as they uncovered this, Kathleen Kenyon, we'll show the video here in just a minute, there was grain everywhere. So it shows, number one, that this was not a long siege, because if it had been, they would have been using the grain. This looks like it was an instantaneous destruction of the city. And moreover, the grain was not taken, which is, again, completely unusual until you go back and look at verse 17 and some of the other parts of this passage. And so you can see that in some ways we have an archaeological verification and a dating for when the destruction of Jericho took place. And that comes from secular scientists who, by the way, could not sign the doctrinal statement at Prestonwood Baptist Church. So I think that's kind of intriguing. Well, again, let's finish this off real quickly. The priest blew the horns. The people shouted. The wall fell. The Israelites entered and devoted the city to destruction. And really, as I said, most of the time is really talking about the preparation and follow-up. The actual battle gets one line in there. And you can see, that, again, the focus here is to really help us understand that from God's point of view, the taking of Jericho was effortless. You know, it was something that was, again, in the Lord's hand. The city was destroyed, but again, a promise that Rahab and her family would be spared. And I showed you over the last couple of weeks the picture of the northern part of this wall that did not fall. All the rest of it fell, but there's one part of the wall that's still standing, and there's a house in that standing. And again, I can't prove that that's Rahab's house, but I think the scriptures make it pretty clear that's probably what it was. And then again says that they were to be spared. But again, what I think is so fun is you look at this later, of course, God gives to Rahab Boaz as a husband. Boaz is, as you can see here, the grandfather of David. And of course, David is of the line that brings all the way to Jesus. So I think it's probably very intriguing in that regard. But also something else. We have this curse at the end. And this curse, interesting enough, was fulfilled. And if you want to put this in your notes, put down 1 Kings 16, verse 34. During the reign of Ahab, you remember Ahab and Jezebel? That was a pretty pagan group, right? You know, anytime you want to have first a leader and then his wife going into, well, I'm not going to say anything about that, but anyway. You always get into trouble when you start talking about husband and wives being presidents, so I will leave that to someone else. But nevertheless, we see that in this case, Hillel the Bethelite actually decided to rebuild Jericho, and the curse of Joshua now comes into effect. And so we'll talk about how that affected his family in just a minute. But nevertheless, we can see that that curse then has a fulfillment later on in 1 Kings 16. Which leads me to my two final conclusion points here before we deal with a couple of other issues. And the first of those is, all the way through this, we see this important issue of the number seven. Number seven. Well, it turns out that it's mentioned 14 different times just in this chapter alone, and seven is the number of divine perfection. It's also seen as the number of completeness. And so we have seven priests, seven trumpets, 7 days, that on the seventh day they make 7 trips around. And so when you see a series of sevens, sometimes that also is an implication of coming judgment, of God will complete his judgment. And so we see that right here in Jericho. Now fast forward, when you go into the book of Revelation, what do we have there? We have 7 trumpets. And so again, the idea of a final completion of God's judgment against disobedience in the earth. And we see that in the tribulation. So if that helps you see a connection between Joshua and the last book of the Bible, Revelation, you can see that that number 7 shows up again. It's primarily used as a number of completeness or of perfection. But also, when they come in a series, sometimes it's the complete judgment. And so we see not only did that happen to Jericho, but we see that it also happens in the book of Revelation. Well, let me come back to this curse for just a minute. Because the curse was a prohibition against refortifying that area, not re-inhabiting it, but the idea of trying to create once again a fortified city. And so we know that during the reign of Ahab, you have Hillel rebuilt the walls at the cost of his sons. And this is exactly what happened. As he laid the foundation, his firstborn son died. And then as he laid the gates for the city, his youngest son died. Now, some people looking at that in 1 Kings say the Hebrews suggest that it's possible that they just died, but it's also possible that this might have been part of a blood sacrifice, that he may have sacrificed his oldest son as a blood sacrifice. And recognize that here in Jericho, this is where you had child sacrifices taking place. So whether he did it at his own hand, or whether or not they died through some process, you see that the curse that Joshua levels here in Joshua chapter 6 on Jericho now is found to later be fulfilled in 1 Kings 16. Kind of interesting. Also, it tells us, interestingly enough, that that was one attempt to refortify it, but really had about 500 years where it just simply was there. And if you look at the remains of Jericho, this is what it looks like today. For those of you that look on your screen, you can see that there are some cars there to give you an idea of this incredible mound. And except for that little strip there and another one over there, those are the only places where anybody's even bothered to do any archaeology. And you can see that they've got fields over here where they plant. And, you know, in some respects, if they could do so, they just plow it under. You know, this is all that's left of the great city of Jericho, if you think about that. It's pretty amazing, but it reminds us again that when indeed God destroys something, it stays destroyed. And never built on it, exists to that day. There's not even any real interest in anybody going back and doing any more archaeological investigation in Jericho. They just, you know, dug a couple of trenches, found a few things, and said, okay, and that's been it. And it sits there really as a reproach, if you will, against paganism. Real quickly, before we watch some of the video, we do get these questions. And one of the questions that Mike asked is, you know, in the Old Testament, you know, God had destroyed things like Jericho, or you could talk about, we're going to see Hazor in just a minute. You know, how is this different from what we have here today biblically? Well, the first answer, of course, is that these were direct and specific commands from God in the Old Testament theocracy for a specific city. which is very different than living in the New Testament, where we have a much different kind of set of circumstances. But more importantly, it does raise some questions that people are asking about. What about these so-called Yahweh wars? Because we have this battle taking place in Cana. And I'm pulling this now from a week of radio programs we have on the Pro website, which I'll mention at the end in case you'd like to read a little bit more. But for example, we can see that one of the key elements was that word that I mentioned a few minutes ago, harem. That means band or banned, and I think the best translation of that we find in our English Standard Version, which is the one we have in the pews there, and that is to devote to destruction. So Canaan and the whole Canaan area was one that God had specifically targeted for destruction. That's very different than today if we fight a battle or a war of defense. But in that particular case, this was a specific command that God had given to them. And so when we talk about the conquest of Canaan, there were really three goals. And I'm covering a very long piece in a very short amount of time. But the first goal, of course, was the movement of Israelites into the land of Canaan. This was really a fulfillment of God's promise to give them that land. And you see that in Genesis 12. And so when Joshua led the people across the Jordan River into Canaan, he was fulfilling that promise. But of course, since the land was not empty, the first issue you have to recognize is he had to move those people out. Which leads to the second issue of the conquest of Canaan, and that was the judgment against the Canaanites. There are a lot of people that indeed point out that how incredibly awful this particular area was. We can see, for example, that eventually when the destruction takes place, Kathleen Kenyon, who I mentioned, you're going to see in the video in just a minute, said the destruction was complete. Walls and floors were blackened or reddened by fire. Every room was filled with fallen bricks, timbers, and household utensils. In most rooms, the fallen debris was heavily burned. And so the question was raised, even at the time, what caused the strong walls of Jericho to collapse? So the secular archaeologists, they said, well, the most likely explanation is an earthquake. But then some of the Christians who were working on this said, yes, but the nature of the earthquake was unusual. It struck in such a way to allow a portion of the city wall in the north side of the site to remain standing, while everywhere else the wall fell. And, of course, we point in the fact that it's quite likely that that's where Rahab's house was. So this was an unusual earthquake, if it was an earthquake. It had more of an attribute of a real significant destruction. Why that destruction? Well, as I point up here, first of all, they worshiped other gods, but especially the Canaanites committed all sorts of other evils. I won't go into all how decadent it was, but you can see what I posted there. They had temple prostitution and things of that nature. In addition to that, we can now learn that they also practiced child sacrifice, as we begin to discover some of that. And matter of fact, one of the best archaeological discoveries in modern times came from a place called Gezer, which was one of the other places destroyed, in which they found all sorts of urns of the burned bodies and bones of children that had been found. So this is a really evil place indeed. And those there were dated between 2000 and about 1500 BC. But again, a lot of that happened even before the Israelites came into that land. The third goal, of course, was the protection of Israel, because if the Canaanites remained in the land, there was a real danger that they would be drawn into these evil practices. And isn't that exactly what took place? Of course, we know the story as well. They would intermarry with them, their spouses would bring the gods into the marriage and all that, and they would be tempted to imitate the Canaanite religious rituals, which were very closely tied to some of the agricultural rhythms. But how do we deal with this other one? Because we see this statement here that they destroyed with a sword every living thing that's in it, men, women, young, old, children, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. Paul Copan, who's written about this, says that in some respects, this was a way to describe a total destruction, but sometimes it was a hyperbolic language, because he says, according to the research that they did, the language used in Joshua 6, is stereotypical Near Eastern language, which actually describes attacks on military forts or garrisons, not general populations that included women and children. Matter of fact, he says there's no archaeological evidence of civilian million populations that were at Jericho or at some of the other places we're going to look at the next couple of weeks. So some people have pointed out the fact that, yes, indeed, there were people that were killed in Jericho, but there was as much statement about disposition as there was destruction. That is, oftentimes they said that they were to dispossess the Canaanites. In other words, to move them out. And there's some arguments that some people are making that when it tells us that their hearts melted, that a lot of the individuals said, I'm out of here. And so they took off. And if you notice, it describes that at one point they shut up the city, because I think what was happening is a lot of people were leaving the city, taking off. And as a result, some of those individuals later did survive and did intermarry with the Israelites, the very danger that they had. So sometimes when we read this, it looks like it's a whole lot worse and it's looked like some kind of terrible kind of genocide. But the reality is probably wasn't that as much. Because of the advance warning, I think it's quite possible that many of the people actually left the city ahead of time. But if you'd like to read a little bit more, this is the article that we have on the Probe website. And it is one of the questions that surfaces every once in a while. Some of the so-called new atheists say, well, this just shows that God was a genocidal maniac. Not really, but nevertheless, I think we have some pretty good answers to that, and I've covered a week of radio programs in about 5 minutes. And so if you'd like to read a little bit more and get some of the nuances, it's on the website probe.org. But I thought just one more time I would play some of the video here so that you can see a little bit more about how this particular researcher, Tim Mahoney, has actually been able to get back and answer some questions. Because if you use the typical dating for the Exodus and the conquest of Cana, they say this doesn't fit. But he says if we work our way back and suggest that maybe the Exodus happened earlier in the middle Bronze Age rather than the late Bronze Age, then first of all, we now have an economic devastation that apparently did happen in Egypt with all the slave labor leaving. And more importantly, it lines up perfectly with the destruction both of Jericho. And if we have time, I think we've got enough time here, I'll play that part with Hazor. And you can begin to see that now as we get into some of the other battles that we'll read about in the next couple of weeks, all the archaeology begins to fit together. So let's, if we can, guys, if we're ready to play that, let's play that video, and then I'll come back and make a short statement before we're concluding.
Looking at the key site of Jericho, the first city the Israelites are said to have destroyed. And we know exactly where that was.
Major archaeological excavations at Jericho began with a German team in the early 1900s, led by Ernst Sellen. This was followed by a British team headed by John Garstang in the 1930s. At the time of their digs, both Sellen and Garstang believed they had uncovered a layer of destruction that matched the biblical story. However, things took a dramatic turn when Kathleen Kenyon dug at Jericho in the 1950s. She demonstrated that there was no evidence for a destruction of Jericho matching the biblical account because she dated the demise of the city much earlier. A wave of skepticism began to sweep across the field of archaeology. In an instant, Kenyon's discoveries at Jericho had undermined the entire Exodus story.
She was expecting that if there was any evidence there at all, it would be in what we call the late Bronze Age. And it simply isn't there. If the Israelites had arrived in the 13th century, they'd have found almost nobody there, no walls to collapse. It just wouldn't have fitted the biblical narrative. So her excavations helped to compound this very negative view that was developing, not just from Jericho, but from other sites as well.
Is there a time when Jericho was destroyed, where the walls fell down or it was burned?
I don't think so. I don't think that we have evidence, this kind of evidence in the case of Jericho. And I don't think that we can really look for this evidence. We are very much past this phase of archaeological research.
But David Roll sees things differently.
If people are telling us that there was no Jericho at the time that Joshua conquered the Promised Land, and therefore Joshua is a piece of fiction, and therefore the conquest is a piece of fiction, and then probably Exodus is a piece of fiction as well. If that's the case, why don't we ask the simple question, well, when was Jericho around? When was Jericho destroyed? And start from that point of view.
The conquest began with the Israelites crossing the Jordan River. Joshua sent men to spy out the massively walled city of Jericho, and there they met a harlot named Rahab, who reported that all in the land had heard what God had done for the Israelites, and they were terrified. Rahab hid the spies and aided their escape to the mountains.
What evidence do you see matching the conquest of Jericho?
First of all, we're told that Jericho was fortified. When the archaeologists dug the city, particularly Kathleen Kenyon, when she did her work in the 50s, discovered that the tell that the city's built on was surrounded by a great earthen rampart.
Excavators found that Jericho was protected by a brilliant defensive system. At its base was a stone retaining wall more than 15 feet high, with a defensive extension wall of mud bricks rising higher still. Beyond this was the rampart, a steep slope covered with a slick surface of white plaster, where attackers would have been exposed to arrows and sling stones from above. At the top of this rampart was the main city wall, also made of mud brick, this one more than 25 feet high and 10 feet thick.
Imagine the dread and the desperate panic of the people of Jericho. Day after day for 6 days, the people of Israel are walking around their city with the Ark of the Covenant and the sounding of ram's horns. Then on the seventh day, they encircle the city seven times, and the priests give a long blast on their horns. The people let loose with a mighty shout. The walls come tumbling down. Allowing the Israelites to climb up into the city, taking it and commencing the conquering of the land of Israel.
Well, when the city met its end, these mud brick walls collapsed, and they actually fell down to the base of the stone retaining wall. Kenyon describes it very clearly and in detail in her excavation report. And then we're told they set the city on fire. And that's exactly what we find. Jericho was massively destroyed by fire. Kenyon said it was very clear that within the city, the walls of the buildings had fallen as well. And she says that the walls fell before the fire. And so we have the sequence that we read in the Bible. First, the fallen walls, and then the city being set on fire by the Israelites.
Excavations at the site uncovered clear evidence for a massive destruction by fire with a very thick burn layer of extremely high temperatures. This caused Kenyon to attribute the burning to an enemy attack and not fires that would result solely from an earthquake.
She claimed that the city was destroyed around 1550 B.C. by the Egyptians. Well, there's absolutely no evidence that the Egyptians were ever in the Jordan Valley at this time period.
So because Kenyon dated the destruction of Jericho 150 years before the Israelites were supposed to be there, she made no connection between the destruction and the biblical account. But once again, this date fits the earlier pattern I've been seeing.
Within the city, a very unique discovery was made. Both Garstang and Kenyon found in the houses that they excavated many jars full of grain that were stored there.
The store jars in the city were pretty full. That suggests the harvest had only recently been gathered in. And the details in the biblical account point to an event that happened sometime in the spring. And down there in the Jordan Valley, spring is when the harvest is gathered in, the grain harvest.
When the Israelites crossed the Jordan, the first thing they did was celebrate Passover. Well, when is Passover? Again, the spring of the year.
The full jars also indicate that if this was a siege, it was very short, unusual for a strong fortified city such as Jericho.
And that matches the biblical account because the siege was only 7 days. Otherwise, the people inside would have consumed a lot of that grain if it dragged out for months.
Was the grain found all over the city?
Yes. In every house that was excavated, they found jars of grain.
There's one other intriguing detail at Jericho that fits the Bible remarkably well. It had to do with a promise made to Rahab.
She actually lived in the city wall, and after hiding the spies, they promised her that she and her family would be protected when they attacked the city. And they kept their promise. She had marked her home with a scarlet cord, which she hung out the window.
But if her house was built into the city wall, how could it have survived?
I came across the actual archaeological report that the German excavator of Jericho, Ernst Sellen, had published in 1913. He was the first to conduct a major excavation of the site, and I could see that his work was impressive, but now seemed to have been forgotten. Here were detailed plans and photographs, including one part of the site, which echoed the Rahab story in an unexpected way.
The Germans found that in this one short stretch on the north side of the city, there were houses built on the rampart between the lower city wall and the upper city wall, and some of those houses were built right up against the lower city wall. They found that the city wall did not fall in this area. So that provides an explanation for how the spies could have saved Rahab and her family, because God brought the wall down everywhere else except where her house was, and we have archaeological evidence to back that up.
Well, what if people say, well, you're biased?
I think everybody in the field is biased one way or another. I admit my bias. However, I cannot make up the evidence. I cannot plant it in the ground. I have analyzed it and compared it to the Bible, and I see, wow, it matches exactly. That's science. Look at your evidence and come to a conclusion based on the evidence.
Archaeologists have uncovered a city with high fortification walls that fell down. Evidence that the city was intentionally burned after the collapse. Storage jars filled with charred grain, evidence of a short siege in springtime. And a section of houses within the wall, miraculously preserved, just as in the biblical account. According to the biblical account, Joshua spoke a curse against anyone who would rebuild the city of Jericho. And the archaeology shows that after the destruction, the city of Jericho was indeed abandoned for centuries. But of course, this all happens in the wrong time in the view of most scholars. Brian Wood believes that Kenyon misdated the pottery at Jericho, resulting in a wrong destruction date. He, along with Charles Ayling, believe that the conquest occurred around 1400 BC using the conventional dates for Egypt and Canaan. However, David Roll and John Bimson have a different idea. They propose that Kenyon came to a wrong destruction date at Jericho because the dates assigned to the Middle Bronze Age are not correct, and these dates for history need a major adjustment. Regardless, all these scholars agree that Jericho was destroyed in a manner that matches the story of Joshua and the Israelites. But there's more to the conquest than just Jericho. Spies had reported that Canaan was a beautiful land, flowing with milk and honey. But it was also filled with great fortified cities that had walls reaching up to heaven. One by one, they would fall to Joshua.
Then Joshua turned north and headed for the city of Hazor. Jabin, king of Hazor, gathered all the kings of the region against Israel. Joshua captured Hazor and struck its king with the sword, and Joshua destroyed Hazor by fire.
Israeli archaeologists at Hazor found a massive burn layer from the same time as Jericho's destruction. They also found something else.
We found tablets in the Middle Bronze Age palace belonging to a king called Jabin. And that's the name of the king that Joshua actually stuck his sword into in the story.
This is the cuneiform tablet containing the name of Jabin, found in remains of the palace in ancient Hatzor.
So you have a connection between the Bible story and these tablets.
We have a name that's identical. We have a tablet coming out of the ground with the name Jabin on it. And in the story of Joshua, Joshua killed King Jabin of Hatzor.
Wow.
But when looking for the conquest...
You can turn it off now if you want. But again, I wanted you just to... A lot of that's in the video, and I'm going to give that to Eunice, and you can borrow it. But isn't that interesting? I kept it going just a little bit longer, and you only got a chance to see about 20 minutes of a two-hour documentary. But the more you get into it, if you start with the assumption that the Bible is true, then you begin to have all these dates line up. And isn't that incredible? Because I shared with you, of course, when we're looking at Joshua chapter 6, the grain that was found. But when we get into Joshua chapter 11, we actually have archaeological evidence of the name of the king that Joshua actually runs through with his sword. Now, at that point, you have enough archaeological evidence to suggest, you know what, maybe the Bible's true and the skeptics are wrong. Parker?